I've been looking forward to this time together to continue our discussion of the Lojong teachings. And for those of you who might be new to Buddhism or to spiritual practice, one of the things that you'll find in the Buddhist tradition is that there are countless methods for how to practice. Right? A lot of appreciation for our multiplicity and for the ways in which we're always changing. And that at one moment in life, we might need a particular way to notice what causes our distress or our anxiety, and to help us feel freed from it. And at other times, we need very different ways of working with the mind and the heart. And so throughout our several years together now, we've explored a number of different Buddhist methods of meditation and reflection. And what we're working on now are these pithy teachings in the Lojong. Lojong translates in Tibetan as mind training, which is not quite as militaristic as it sounds, right? It's really meant to evoke a lot of curiosity about how the mind operates. Because if you're like me, it can sometimes feel that the mind has its own agenda, right? That we seem to set a lot of intentions, and then the mind does something completely different, right? It goes off into its own orbit, its own rather ornate reality that often doesn't seem to have that much to do with what we were hoping for or intending. And in a way, I really appreciate this about the mind, even though it can drive us crazy, right? The mind is so rich. It's so complex, right? It's so multifaceted. And in the Buddha Dharma, or the teachings of the Buddha, you find a real psychological appreciation for that complexity. And thus, the many, many layers of the mind that are described in the Abhidharma, or the texts of Buddhist psychology. And the general idea being that the more surface layers of the mind, we can more readily access, right? Strong feelings, for instance, right? Desire, rage, envy, terror, right? These are feelings that tend to grip us, and we can access those states of mind very easily. But in a Buddhist understanding of the mind, you can keep going, right? You can respect those more accessible parts of the mind, and then just keep plumbing the depths to see what's underneath them, right? What are the beliefs that give rise to those feelings, right? What are the elements of our history that we're carrying with us that we're not even conscious of? And you really find a very psychodynamic understanding of the mind and the Dharma, right? That we've got these levels of mind that we can pretty easily lift into awareness, and then many, many, many layers that are just as powerful, but less conscious. Now, interestingly, in the Buddha Dharma, the deepest layer of which we tend not to be conscious is our mind of clear seeing, right? The mind of openness and clarity that can simply recognize what's happening, whatever that might be, right? Because a lot of weird stuff happens to most of us a lot of the time, right? So in the Dharma, you don't find a very positive spin or a Pollyanna-ish spin on reality. Mm-hmm. You know, the Buddha acknowledged reality is pretty complex. But that deepest layer of mind is prepared simply to notice, to recognize this reality. And without all of the customary evaluating and reacting and pushing away what we don't want and grasping onto what we hope will not go away. And so these next few teachings circle around this overarching perspective of the mind as a way of helping us, again, just stay oriented. It's almost like a spiritual GPS, if you will, right? We might think we should turn right here, but if we can just remember, or if something can help us remember that actually, in order to get to our destination, we might actually need to go in another direction. You know that experience, I know that experience where my mind is telling me, no, I'm sure it's this way, right? And I've simply made a decision that that is so. Only to find that I've ended up in another state. Definitely not where I intended to go, right? The mind tends to hold fast to what it thinks to be true. And thus, in all spiritual traditions, there are these very compassionate reminders, respectful and compassionate reminders, that perhaps there's another way to approach what we feel we can only approach by turning right, by going in this direction. So the first 50 teaching is change your attitude, but remain natural. Change your attitude, but remain natural. Now, I'll read the first couple of lines, I think is a very helpful reminder. It says, Lojong practice is about transforming the way we view the world, not changing the way we present ourselves to it. I really like that. Right? Lojong, and you could say by extension, all the teachings of the Buddha are about transforming the way we view the world and not changing the way we present ourselves to it. Now, I think part of what this teaching is opening up is that for some of us, maybe many of us, it can feel as though an identity is forming around our spiritual pursuits. Right? It can feel as though we might even be getting a little bit separate from others as a result of certain insights or a new paradigm for navigating life. And this book, which was written by Treleg Kubgon, who is Tibetan, talks about how Tibetan culture really privileges humility. And that it became apparent that there was a temptation when people discovered the Dharma and really started practicing it to feel, ironically, separate from those who weren't exploring this spiritual path. And I think this is true in all faith traditions, right? There's almost a sense of, okay, we're on to something, and you're still holding fast to the usual stuff that we used to turn to, right? The woefully benighted. And what I love about this teaching is there's really no judgment, right? It's very human to feel separate from others based on any impactful experience, right? Even a spiritually opening experience, right? There might be this covert or subtle sense that we're not on the same page, right? And so this teaching, change your attitude but remain natural, is saying, yeah, stick with your spiritual pursuits. Like keep getting curious about what's happening inside your mind and in your heart. and especially the impact of those arisings. Right? What helps you feel a sense of relaxation and connection and basic trust and well-being? And what stirs anxiety, a feeling of separateness, anger, right? Frustrated rage, whatever it might be? Sustain that curiosity, right? Change, that's what change your attitude means, right? Really, really stay deeply curious about the truth of what you feel, right? How you think, what helps and what harms. But see if it's possible to do so while softening any tendency to feel a sense of separate identity forming around that curiosity. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, because for those of you who have heard our wonderful teachers like Asonis, the Dalai Lama, I used to be very struck by this. Almost inevitably, he would say, don't worry about becoming a Buddhist. You don't have to take robes, right? You don't have to be a card-carrying member, right, of the Buddhist tradition in order to cultivate compassion, insight, right? It's the latter that is really important. And he'll often say, please cultivate your own faith tradition and relationship to those communities while working with your mind skillfully. Right? Change your attitude and remain natural. Such a helpful teaching. Yeah. Now, the next teaching is connected to this 50 teaching. And this one, I think, will quickly remind you of many other teachings that you've heard, and maybe even a sense of your moral compass that you internalized early in life. Although it's hard to abide by this one. Don't talk about others' weak points. Don't talk about others' weak points. You know, we're all smiling, thinking, I do this all the time. I seem like the nicest person, but the mind seems to want to go there. Right? This person doesn't behave the way they said they would behave, right? This person has been driving me crazy for 50 years with their hair, and I can write novels about the 12 ways they drive me crazy. And not just me, they drive everybody crazy.
I posted a terribly negative feedback review on somebody's company today.
Well, it's good to notice. Right? Good to reflect. Yes. Yeah, we all do it. Right? The mind seems to want to defend ourselves, and especially to defend a feeling of separateness. Right, by pointing out the weakness of others. Yeah, don't talk about others' weak points. Now, this is such a challenging teaching. Because it almost feels like an addiction, right? I mean, there's something deeply gratifying to us about fully understanding what makes everybody else inadequate. And of course, the hard thing to keep in mind is people do that about us too. We think we're the only ones, right? Musing on everybody else's shortcomings, but everybody is on the receiving end of this tendency. I know. And it's a terrible feeling, right? The thought of somebody else hanging out with people we've never met, talking about all of our shortcomings. It's very, very demoralizing. It doesn't help us feel well. It doesn't cultivate trust. Right? It doesn't help us heal from loss or betrayal. And so, even just lifting to awareness, it's so tempting, right, to pivot our attention away from the reality of what's happening inside us to what everybody else is doing or not doing. Right, because it takes courage, it takes nobility to say, yeah, I'm gonna try to understand myself without losing connection with others, right? I'm not gonna do this in a narcissistic way. But I'm gonna take supreme responsibility for what's happening in my own mind and heart. Instead of repetitively, chronically, obsessively, no judgment, because I do this too, right? Talking about, thinking about, sometimes going crazy about what everyone else is doing wrong. And I don't mean to suggest, because this is a wonderful group, right? I know you also spend a lot of time being in support of others and wishing them well and doing whatever you can, right, to nurture their well-being, right? So that's equally true. But this particular Pithi teaching wants to suggest that when the mind gets fixated on other people's shortcomings, it generates suffering. It doesn't actually help us feel better. If you read the commentary on this teaching, it says, rather than fixating on the results of people's problems, try to stay curious about the causes. Try to notice the conditions that generate the difficulties. That's actually very helpful. Because then what happens often is some new space in the mind opens, right? There's a sense of decompression of, oh, I get why this is happening. Doesn't necessarily eliminate the pain, right? But the awareness can hold the dynamic. We'll do just one more teaching, which is very, very similar to this last teaching of don't talk about others' weak points, which is don't think about the affairs of others. Don't think about the affairs of others. Now, this is such an interesting teaching. And as I was rereading the commentary, I was remembering countless conversations that I've had with friends where we were analyzing other people we knew, trying to assess what was happening in their marriage or why they had partnered with a particular person or why they were navigating their career in a particular way. And we always had some righteous feeling of entitlement, right, to that reflection, right, of thinking about the affairs of others. And I remember getting to a point where I realized this is a total projection. I am projecting my own stuff that I have not yet grappled with. I'm seeing it in someone else. I'm having all sorts of feelings and thoughts about their choices and their experience. And perhaps in some grandiose way, I'm imagining that if they only asked, I could tell them, only to realize, oh, this is a monumental distraction, right? From my own experience, struggle, longing that I have placed in another. And so this commentary says, the Lojong commentary reminds us that our criticism and interpretations about others' lives are simply our own projections and perceptions. So instead of categorically condemning people's actions or just ruminating about them, we should learn to give them the benefit of the doubt. There's an act of compassion, right? Yeah. Don't think about the affairs of others. And so in a way, if I could just add to this teaching some gentleness, perhaps if we started a few steps before, right? If you notice that you are thinking about the affairs of others, again, perhaps to Maggie's question and point, right, what could come in to just shift that tendency to interrupt the pattern? Just the mindfulness, just the recognition. Huh, I've just spent the last half an hour thinking about somebody's relationship. I've never actually discussed it with them in the last 40 years, but here I am thinking about it again. I wonder why. What is it I'm longing for or needing? Right? Sometimes we have people in our lives and we think if only they had taken these actions. You might have people in your lives whom you love and you see gifts in them that are not fully realized. And you're thinking a lot about how if only they would let themselves be better known or risk exposure or take the opportunities that presented themselves, then they'd be flourishing. And that's really different, I think, from the compassion around their struggles. I want to suggest it's a distancing mechanism from our own mind, right, from our own experience.
Accepting is a big part of it.
Yeah.
You can get to that point where you know that you're doing it, you know that they do have certain issues that they might even discuss. And just letting it go and just accepting it and enjoying the time that you have with them and just enjoying it to the max.
Right, lovely. Right. So that's the second part of mindfulness. Right? The first part is just the recognition of what's happening. Right? And then it's the acceptance. This is what's happening in my mind. And then trying to work with it so that something shifts, so that you can get to the enjoyment. Okay. It really speaks to that capacity. Again, to plumb the depths, right? So below all of the layers of frustration and desire, anger, etc., to get to that common humanity and to let that be our organizing principle, right? So that if someone is not present, in the Dharma there are these reminders to not speak about people who aren't present. It's very similar, right? Be respectful of those who are not present. And again, no judgment, because if we're feeling hurt or misunderstood, right, it's very tempting to want to continue to evoke, right, people's shortcomings, especially if they're not present, because it can feel safer. But then just noticing that, right? And working toward that wish to feel our common humanity.